Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Conflict Management Among Irregular Immigrants, the Micropolitics of Intercultural Respect. This talk is delivered by Professor Paul Clough.
Good evening and welcome to the second talk in the series of the Work in Progress seminars. And to everybody over here, of course, Professor Paul Clough will need no introduction. However, for our radio audience, I should say that Professor Clough is an anthropologist. He's long been the coordinator for anthropology over here. And he's worked in Nigeria and also Tanzania, primarily in economic anthropology. And his interest in work in Africa and also in Tanzania too has led to his recent work on migrants in Malta, and he's going to be giving us a talk on managing African immigrants, the politics of respect. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good evening, everybody. My paper is entitled Conflict Management Among African Irregular Immigrants, the Micropolitics of Intercultural Respect. Micropolitics crept into the title because it seemed so appropriate to what I'm about to describe. This paper is a fine-grained case study of one single incident and how it unfolded. In their book, A Thousand Plateaus, Deleuze and Guattari discuss at some length Gabriel Tarde. His long-forgotten work was at one time quite well-known and much criticized by none other than Durkheim himself. But as Deleuze and Guattari say, Durkheim's preferred objects of study were the great collective representations, which are generally binary, resident, and overcoded. Tarde countered Durkheim with the idea that collective representations presuppose exactly what needs explaining, namely how millions of people are similar. That is why Tarde was interested instead in the world of detail, or the infinitesimal, the little imitations, oppositions, and inventions constituting an entire realm of sub-representative matter. Well, I certainly, without further reference to Gabriel Tarde, who I'd very much like to explore, am going to be looking at an infinitesimal world. My argument in this paper is that the ethical motivations or ethical principles of actors in conflicts have been under-theorized in anthropology and sociology, particularly in studies of conflict. Most studies analyze conflicts in terms of the material interests or ideological legitimations which the actors bring to bear, or they invoke network theory, i.e., these are all analyses in terms of the formal rationality of actors in a conflict. In contrast, this particular case study I'm going to give attempts a phenomenological analysis of ethics as it is lived and experienced. The paper focuses on a single case study of the management of conflict among African immigrants in an open center established by the government of Malta. It is offered as an analysis of management success. But it is written from a very particular point of view, that of part-time research. Because in 2006, at the time of the study, I was heavily committed to full-time administration and teaching in the anthropology department of the University of Malta, I had limited time to observe or question all parties to the conflict. Indeed, the listeners will see that I probe conflict management largely through the eyes of the two managers involved, for that was the vantage point available to me at the time. Thus, this study is very different from the kind based on full-time research done by those who have the luxury of time off from their regular work. In consequence, it does not claim to achieve that holistic picture of all factors normally desirable in anthropological research. Furthermore, this analysis falls in the domain of what I would call the anthropology of advocacy, in the very specific sense that I was there at the center of this conflict because I saw my role as one of long-term help to Africans living in difficult conditions. It is thus a record of anthropology in action. Since the mid-1990s, there has been a growing flow of Africans who arrive in Malta from North Africa, mainly from Libya, as part of a long-term trajectory of flight from conflict zones or from poverty in Africa. African immigrants never see Malta as a final destination, but they rather see it as a stepping stone to other much bigger countries like Britain, Germany, or the United States. Until approximately 2002, the number of these African immigrants remained small, and they were easily housed by the Catholic NGO delegated responsibility by the government, which found them work mainly as construction laborers on large hotel projects. Since 2002, however, and especially after Malta's membership of the EU in 2004, the flow of Africans has increased dramatically. Numbers fluctuate continuously because immigrants are leaving for Europe as well as arriving from North Africa. As of December 2005, there was a total of approximately 2,500 against the Maltese population of some 400,000. In 2009, the total fluctuated between 6,000 and 7,000. Most are young men. Most of these immigrants have arrived in Malta after paying for dangerous journeys in small boats from Libya. Many die at sea. Many have spent a considerable length of time in Libya. Most originate from conflict zones in Africa, from which they have fled after paying for arduous journeys by land across the Sahara Desert. In consequence, the great majority of immigrants in Malta originate from Somalia, Eritrea, Sudan, the Congo, and Ivory Coast. A minority started their journeys in Liberia, Sierra Leone, other countries of West Africa, Iraq, and Palestine. The majority of immigrants are Muslim. This has provoked a widespread and anxious discourse about the threat to our cultural identity among the mainly Catholic population of Malta. So far, the two major political parties have managed to distance themselves from this discourse at election times. But tiny right-wing splinter parties attract much attention in the media between elections. Many immigrants are rescued at sea by the armed forces of Malta. Since 2002, all are placed in detention upon arrival, where most have remained for at least a year. The legal maximum period for detention is 18 months, but under pressure from the EU, the government has generally reduced this to 12 months, and sometimes less. While in detention, all are interviewed with a view to establishing their origin and status. Most apply for refugee status. In this process, they receive free legal assistance from the UNHCR Malta office, the Jesuit Refugee Service, or the Emigrant Commission. If their application for refugee status is rejected by the refugee commissioner, more often than not the case, they have the right of appeal to the Refugee Appeals Board. Government policy is to release detainees into open centers. While residing at open centers, the great majority, sooner or later, find paid employment in the host society. Some have taken on highly skilled jobs. Most are manual laborers in the construction industry of one sort or another. This paper concentrates on Marsa Open Center as a case study of one particular micro-political event. There are various official centers for the housing of immigrants released from detention in Malta. In December 2005, Marsa Open Center, hereinafter MOC, was the largest, had 400 residents, and was constantly expanding. The government had delegated its running to a local NGO, who were and are provided with governmental and EU funds. From July 2004 until his resignation in August 2008, over that four-year period, the manager of MOC was an officer of this NGO, Mr. Terry Gosden, an English residential social worker with dual nationality and a Maltese wife. During that time, Terry Gosden developed, with great speed, under conditions of stress, a uniquely harmonious residence in which immigrant males from many different conflict zones were encouraged to live together peacefully, find employment in the Maltese labor market, pool their resources in the joint ownership of entertainment facilities within MOC, which could not be provided from limited state funds, individually invest as private entrepreneurs in the development of restaurants, shops, and internet outlets on the premises. develop mosques, prayer rooms, and religious schools which express the diverse religious needs of the immigrants. In March 2006, the Council of Europe underlined many shortcomings in the treatment of immigrants, which needed to be addressed by the government of Malta. Nonetheless, it ended by singling out the Marsa Open Center as a dynamic and successful site of migration management. This paper explores a single case of conflict within MOC in order to probe the dynamics of conflict management. MOC is a large former school in the socially marginal dockland of Marsa at the end of Grand Harbor. The majority of residents were and are Somalis, among many African national and ethnic groups. But since the eruption of the genocide in Darfur, an increasing number are from Sudan. Terry Gosden, the manager, hereinafter G, had responded to the pleas of various national groups by letting either individuals or national groups lease and manage restaurants, large rooms where they had kitchens, tables, and benches, and cooked their local dishes. One of these was the Sudanese restaurant, under the overall control of a committee of Sudanese immigrants. It had delegated the task to a middle-aged manager, whom I will call Jibril. Like a number of Sudanese in MOC, he was not actually from Darfur. Jibril was an Arab born and raised in Sudan. In August 2006, i.e. about 2 years after many harmonious arrangements were up and running, Gosden G was confronted by a strong demand from a group of Sudanese that he displace Jibril and hand over the management of the Sudanese restaurant to them. He refused. Only 2 days later, damage was done inside the restaurant. The police were called in, and the restaurant was closed. G, as manager, was faced with three realistic options. One, keep the restaurant closed. This would reaffirm his own authority and that of the government's immigration services, but risk discontent among Sudanese residents and a deterioration in the intercultural harmony which had been characteristic of the center. Two, hand the restaurant back to Jibril, thereby confirming his managerial control of MOC, but risking intra-group conflict among the Sudanese. The third option was negotiate between Jibril and his opponents. This would risk his own authority, but turn an escalating conflict into a more peaceful process. In fact, he chose the last option. At the end of the case, after intense and delicate discussions, he managed to reopen the Sudanese restaurant with a new manager and his authority enhanced. This paper analyzes how. One of the first innovations that G had introduced was the appointment of an immigrant resident at the MOC as his deputy on the NGO payroll, Mr. Warsami Garare. Warsami had himself been in detention. Highly educated, quiet, diplomatic, this sensitive man in his early 30s was fluent in Arabic, the lingua franca among Somalis and Sudanese, French, Italian, and English. He became G's intermediary with many residents. So this case study is really the story of their creative partnership. I briefly discuss my methods of research. I approached part-time fieldwork in MOC from the standpoint of practical engagement. Being a specialist in West African ethnography, with many years of experience in Nigeria and a working knowledge of Hausa, the main language of northern Nigeria, spoken also by many Africans in other parts of the Sahel, I always saw my role in immigration research in Malta as different from the strictly scientific activity of my former research in Nigeria. I was in MOC basically to give back to Africans a small portion of the many gifts of knowledge and friendship that had been bestowed on me when I was on their continent. Since I was then head of the anthropology division at the university and had much African experience, G often called on me for discussion and advice. He gave me, and it must be said, my research students as well, support, free movement, in what was, under his leadership, a uniquely open center. I was invited to most of the meetings discussed below. The case study below is drawn from my field notes of the time, without any change except shortening. However, when writing this paper, I did read out my field notes to G. so that he could recall his version of the events. And I invited him to reflect back on his experiences as manager. Thus, this paper is, as much as anything, a scrutiny of one man's approach to intercultural social work. Two facets of G's life need to be emphasized. First, his appointment to MOC was his first work experience of Africans. Thus, this paper records part of a steep learning curve in which G was immersed as manager of a center for Africans. Secondly, G is a man with personal experience of poverty and social marginality. After leaving secondary school, he spent 6 years as a diver in the Royal Navy before beginning a career at the deep end of residential social work in London. In his own words, "I come from the bottom of South London society. When I was in my teens, there were weeks when the only food was a packet of muffins. I'm not kidding. I'm lucky. All of my peer group in South London are gone, to drugs, to theft, to prison." All the more interesting, then, that G is coldly analytical in his approach to human situations, with a penchant for political analysis. His favorite expression in analyzing human encounters is "the game." Intriguingly, this has made him highly adapted to Malta, where the same expression is used up and down the social spectrum. His words to me on many occasions have been, "Play the game. It's an honorable game." He is so soft-spoken that he is sometimes difficult to hear, but his mind is fundamentally political in its reaction to interpersonal dynamics, in the specific sense that he sees issues of power as being foremost in the fissure between human beings. This political sense and a tendency to respond flexibly reveal themselves in his account of his first arrival scene at MOC, the moment of his first appointment and arrival at Marsa Open Center. He had been seconded to the government by his NGO. "As I drove in, a group of perhaps 95 Somalis were surrounded by approximately 15 soldiers, some with batons raised. There was a group on my right of top civil servants that I didn't recognize at the time. I was at a distance of 100 feet from the Somalis and soldiers. I could feel the fear and the coming pain. And I screamed at the top of my voice, not really usual, 'What the hell are you doing?' I walked up and told all the soldiers to go to the office." He then dismissed all except two of them later in the day. "I asked X, an influential member of the NGO who had recommended his secondment, to take aside the group of top civil servants on the right. I led the asylum seekers." Gosden never uses the popular Maltese term irregular immigrants. "I led the asylum seekers up the stairs to the bedrooms. I didn't even know where the bedrooms were. I wanted to reassure them that I was not a policeman. I wonder where the strength came from." It is also germane that G has read his way through much literature and has a special fondness for Machiavelli and J.R. Tolkien. J.R. Tolkien was my escape when I was young and everything around me was hell. Reading has fortified G's love of words, a sensitivity to language that was arguably essential in the events below. I now read to you this case study. It's entitled "From My Field Notes." I interspersed the comments made by G when he listened to these field notes. 1. The threat. 28 August 2006. I received a phone call from Terry, so I joined him at the pub after 10 p.m. "There is a new problem at MOC. A very heavy group of Sudanese men had come to see him and had threatened force if he did not dismiss Jibril as manager of the Sudanese restaurant and given it to them. G had never met such toughness before. They were threatening him. He calmly advised them to think again before taking action, but he was shaken. It was, he said, clearly a dangerous situation. While all the power was in his hands, there was the likelihood of some sort of violence. But the real point was that he had never met a group of immigrants who were so set in their determination to threaten him with force. 2. The fight. I, Paul Clow, I arrived at MOC at 4:45 p.m. Maria, a graduate volunteer, immediately accosted me with, "You are late." I laughed and said, "No, I am not. I am bloody well on vacation." She needed help. She was alone. No one else on duty. I dished out what seemed like 100 Jablo packets of fish, peas, and potatoes, since most did not want the pasta dish. Unlike the year before, most immigrants were cold. Not unfriendly, but not courteous either. They took the bread and water without a thank you, and the fish if they chose. It was by now 6:30 of a Saturday afternoon, and a large group of young men off work were now gathering in the courtyard. Then suddenly my mobile rang, and it was G, telling me urgently to get back in the office. There had been a fight in the Sudanese restaurant, and someone had called the police, and he had just been told. The crowd saw me suddenly with Maria returning to the office. She was only too glad to be back in its safety. I immediately called Terry and asked, "Do I have freedom to move around now since I am not staff?" Terry smiled over the phone and answered, "You are free, but be careful." Back at the courtyard, I could see that Jibril had locked the door to the Sudanese restaurant and was standing in front of it alongside his enemies. A crowd of Sudanese had gathered, but really no more than about 50. Almost at once, the police arrived. Three plunged into the middle of the crowd. Two young constables stood at the edge of the crowd and showed no sign of wanting to enter it. Four older policemen remained at a distance. A big, tall young policeman volubly engaged both Jibril and his enemies. He was at the center, and he was very poised. In a loud voice, he talked with Terry on the phone, so that all who understood English could hear what he was saying. "Terry, there seems to be a management problem here. I advise you to settle it. In the meantime, we think we should take the key because your only staff present is a woman." He then gestured and muttered apologetically in Maltese to Maria. "And we think it unsafe to leave her with the key. You can collect it from the police station." Maria mobile G, who told her to tell the policeman that he was coming. The big cop said loudly to Terry on the mobile, "All I can see is 500 angry faces, and I think it best that we, the police, keep the key to the restaurant, and you come and collect it." So led by him, all of the police moved out. The crowd easily dispersed. How funny that he should have translated 50 men into 500 angry faces. I introduced myself to him. He was very relaxed, pleasant, and direct. He said to me, "I think that the group of protesters see money in the restaurant, and they want a share of the pie." It was a shrewd observation. At the office door, the big cop said to me in excellent English, "I am actually only a constable," and he gesturally deferred to his sergeant. The sergeant, old, grim, and a bit suspicious, took down Maria's particulars as the staff on duty. Another older policeman said to me, "They are a village here." It took me some seconds to understand, and then I had to agree. It's true, they form a self-contained community here. His had been an acute observation. At the other restaurant, the Somali restaurant, Idris, an older, well-made paid mechanic living outside MOC, looked at me through his glasses and mustache, and keeping his face very much in reserve, said, "Zagawa, Zagawa. These troublemakers are all Zagawa. And these Sudanese, you see what trouble they cause." Which was strange, since he himself was Sudanese. "No trouble at the Somali restaurant, or the Eritrean restaurant." And then he said, "They are trying to take Jibril's restaurant from him. But can Jibril do without a restaurant? What work can he do in Malta? He is too old." I pressed Idris if Jibril had made mistakes as manager of the restaurant. There was no answer, but a few minutes later he suddenly said, "Jibril does not know how to talk to people, and there are many." He meant many who were unhappy with him. A few minutes later, he added, "These people want to take the restaurant from Jibril because they know that in Ramadan, the restaurant will be crowded every night after the fast is broken, and they will make lots of money." And he asked two Somalis eating nearby when Ramadan would begin, and they answered him and me in English, "At the beginning of November." In other words, 3 months after the incident I'm describing. That night, Terry came to the bar just outside MOC, having parked his car by the office, but would not stay inside MOC, believing it could only worsen matters. He had easily obtained the key from the police, bantering with them, with exchange jobs with me. Jibril, the restaurant manager, that was very calm that night, but said he had made a police report. Here are G's comments on my field notes. The day after the incident, I regained the key and gave it to Jibril to take his food out of the restaurant, and he opened the restaurant against my instructions. That's when they destroyed the food. Then one of them came and threatened me with his walking cane as I stood with my back to the open door of the restaurant. He wanted access. I refused. Someone again called the police, but I sent the police back. 40 to 50 Sudanese were there. The man waved the knotted head of his wooden cane, banged the door of the restaurant, did all he could to frighten me. I had no option except to meet his challenge. He disappeared into the crowd. Then one of the tallest Sudanese men, actually a very nice chap, bent round me, extremely careful not to touch me, and locked the door behind my back. Once the door was locked, everybody dispersed. I went back to my office for extreme caffeine intake. 2 days later, I spoke in depth about the situation with Warsami. This is G talking. Jibril was hovering very closely by me and Warsami at all times, with his opponents hovering within eyesight in small but cohesive groups outside the office. Their presence was ominous and clearly made Jibril nervous. Jibril claimed that food had been destroyed and money stolen. Both I and Warsami quietly between ourselves found this very hard to believe. While we knew food had been destroyed, we knew of no situation where money had been stolen among Sudanese at MOC, where there was hardship all the way around. But we kept our minds open to Jibril's complaint, since he seemed to have no support in any quarter. At this time, I made the decision that if force was going to win over the individual, I would put up maximum resistance to gratuitous acts of violence for gain. And from then on, this was the game plan. And to learn as much as possible about the underlying problems, reasons, methodology, and characters of all concerned. Battle lines had been drawn. Everybody was prepared for war. There was something coming. There was no hate, nothing personal between me and any of the group, because they had no reason to attack me personally. So they attacked the only way they could, logically. I now return to my field notes. That evening, G negotiated with a big group of Sudanese. He had discovered that Jibril had refused to allow Sudanese to perform two ceremonies in the restaurant, a wedding feast and a funeral feast. For the importance of Sudanese feasting ceremonies as performances of collective belonging in the open centers of Marsa and Halfar, see the BA dissertation by André Calouf, 2007. G had, this was, then I have the comments by G again. The feasts were not in line with Jibril's background as an Arab, but were in line with indigenous custom. This pinpointed to me the differences between Arab and indigenous populations in Sudan. This was my first clue to understanding the conflict in Marsa. My field notes again. G had also found out that Jibril had indeed talked badly to some Sudanese. He then told the group that Jibril would go as manager, but that all sides must swear on the Quran as to the amount of money missing and the amount of food destroyed. He believed that on the Quran, Jibril would reduce his claims to damages and the others would reimburse him. Then G could reopen the restaurant under new management. 4. The second meeting. The following day, I attend the meeting. I, Paul Clough. Warsami was translating between English and Arabic. Besides Jibril, there was a group of four men, three young, one mature. According to G, the most articulate members of the previous day's group were missing. All had stony faces and angry eyes, never a letdown in their front. They were soft-spoken but adamant. They said that the previous day's agreement with G no longer held. No one was prepared to swear on the Quran. There was much discussion of this, an effort to make clear to G that only the accuser, not the accused, can swear in Islam. They said that since Jibril had decided on legal action in the Maltese courts, they would fight the case too. But they expected G to honor his promise to open the restaurant under new management. G, calm, discursive, quietly firm, kept them in conversation. He pointed out that both parts of the agreement must be honored, that he could not open the restaurant if the case were in court, since he would appear prejudiced in favor of the group, that he would therefore come into disrepute and lose his job. He was alerted by their vote fas with regard to swearing on the Quran, and quickly pointed out that even in a Maltese court, they would be made to swear on the Quran. Later, he told me this made them flinch. After everyone left, he voiced the thought to Warsami that he did now suspect that Jibril had indeed some claim to damages. At the end of the meeting, Jibril quietly claimed 500 lira was missing and 150 lira of food destroyed, 650 lira in all. G quietly indicated to all that the restaurant would remain closed indefinitely unless they worked out a mutual agreement by African culture. Here is G's comment on this meeting. At the start of every meeting, I made sure I gave long salutations for family, friends, about the weather. At the end of every meeting, no matter how arduous the meeting had been, I made sure everyone shook hands and said, thank you. From my field notes again. That night, driving Warsami home to his room in Valletta, Warsami said to me, this group of troublemakers have recently left detention. They do not understand the working of Marsa Open Center, with the exception of the one man who had agreed to stay and listen to Jibril in the meeting. They used force inside detention and believe it is the only way to get what they want. Warsami continued, Jibril must be removed, but the restaurant should remain closed for some time until G finds the right manager. Otherwise, force will rule at Marsa Open Center. It's a bad example. Later that evening, in the pub, G was extremely worried and tired. His reconstruction is that the real ringleaders are known, but behind the scenes. They were controlling the group speakers. Hence, those faces expressed worry as well as anger. The ringleaders had refused to swear on the Quran, since its misuse would have repercussions in an open center where at least half were Muslim. They were not backing down, however, and were still seeking to force G to open the restaurant. He had a mind to get the restaurant declared unsafe by the public authorities. Otherwise, he saw only trouble and conflict between Jibril and the rest, and an escalation. 5. The African deputy goes into action. The following day, at G's bidding, Warsami took the reins in order to try to negotiate with those Sudanese who might make a difference to the final outcome of the conflict. From 4 in the afternoon until almost 7 p.m., he was closeted in discussion elsewhere in the center. G could do nothing but hope and try to take his mind off the problem, since he had placed it beyond his own hands. His office and the adjoining one were always crowded with his assistants, volunteers, and sometimes foreign journalists or academics coming to visit MOC. That afternoon, he appeared calm. He played his guitar and sang. Here is G's comment on my field notes. My guitar is a way of escaping into my own head. The guitar is a total switch-off, and singing, because you've got to believe in what you're singing at the time. Again from my field notes. Warsami's meeting brought together the imam of the mosque at Marsa Open Center, who was an Eritrean, Jibril, the Sudanese restaurant manager, and the old original committee who had set up the Sudanese restaurant. Interestingly, the meeting took place in the mosque, a mosque which G had opened, promoted 2 years previously. At 6:50 p.m., Warsami was able to convey to G a provisional agreement. G was extremely grateful. He said, you should be sitting here, Warsami. G told me this. It was partly a question of not acting or avoiding action to allow both sides to negotiate. It was, even more importantly, a question of maintaining the whole rhythm of MLC. I was not at the time thinking about my job, but about the maintenance of the whole temper of the place. From my field notes. 6. Warsami's account of the conflict and of the final agreement. A year ago, a committee of Sudanese went to G asking him for a club in Ramadan, a Sudanese tradition when there is much collective feasting after sunset when people break their Ramadan fast. They all contribute money for food. In addition, in Ramadan, Sudanese share all. There is a kind of similarity between Ramadan in Niger, Nigeria, and Sudan. The club had written rules. It had a written membership and membership fees. In case of a funeral of a relative back in Sudan, money was given to the bereaved in MOC to send to the relatives of the deceased in Sudan. A year ago, after Ramadan, Jibril asked the committee members if he could convert the club into a commercial restaurant. He needed their permission, and he got it, because he is too old to do manual labor like the others. They are not averse to private enterprise, provided there is collective food sharing in the month of Ramadan. Then Jibril approached G and got his agreement to open it as a restaurant. Thereafter, said Warsami, all of the Sudanese in MOC know this history. The big new problem is that the old committee of 1 year ago, quote, are all very wise and intelligent, unquote. They are 30, but the recent arrivals from detention are 50. While it was agreed in the mosque that Jibril was bad of speech and had used insulting words, the old committee members were angry that they had never been consulted by the newcomers about encounters with G or the newcomers' attempts to take over the restaurant. The two outsiders, Warsami and the Imam, pressed on the old committee that the reputation of Sudanese at MOC is at stake. So it was agreed that Jibril would not mention any damages of 650 lira. He would withdraw his court case. He would merely ask for a period of time, running through Ramadan, to recover losses and then hand over. Everything would be in the hands of the old committee. They would run the restaurant, but give the earnings to Jibril until he had recovered his losses. After Ramadan, a new committee would be elected by all of the Sudanese, and G would appoint a new manager. The old committee had until the following weekend to talk with everyone, i.e. all Sudanese, and obtain agreement. I wrote in my field notes at the time that it was a brilliant agreement if it held on the weekend. That night, driving Warsami home to his room in Valletta, he said, Jibril is an Arab, and so he is hated by the Sudanese from Darfur, especially by the Zagawa of the north. They led the rebellion against Khartoum. They suffered many losses. Jibril used insulting words about the people from Darfur. Zagawa are easily the majority among the Sudanese at Marsa Open Center. There are also Fur, Tama, and others. 7. The third meeting. The day after the agreement brokered by Warsami, G meets the old committee and Warsami in his office. I record the Imam of the mosque, three older Sudanese, and several others being present. The meeting was very cordial. Most spoke. G spoke at length to the effect that this incident is a wake-up call for me. I must not leave any group to fester. The weekend does not start until tomorrow. So the committee did not announce any specific agreement, but G knew privately what the score was. They will tell Jibril what they are going to do. Probably he will be given 500 lira or maybe 400 lira. When I talk with him, he is not mentioning goods or money anymore to me. Nevertheless, G was worried because, quote, even yesterday, Jibril had phoned a volunteer at MOC who is also a lawyer, but I told her not to intervene. Through all of this, G is beset by other worries. He has been informed officially that free food for all the immigrants at MOC stops finally in 1 month's time, i.e. in September 2006, and will be replaced by a daily stipend. Some may go hungry. That night at the pub, I asked G, why does Warsami keep such restraint yet give so much? G answered as follows. Warsami and I have seen too much damage in our lives. There's a quote by Bertolt Brecht, for evil to succeed, it only takes good men to walk away. Warsami's bound by the same code as I am, but we don't need to talk about it. We can't walk away. 8. The final meeting. 4 days later, I arrive half an hour before the meeting. I check and correct a reference that G has written for Warsami, and G signs. Then the committee enters the room. 7 people. The imam, a small dark young man, a mature dark man, more Arabic than African, the others call him Sheikh, a lean tall man in his later 30s, a mustachioed man smoking at one end of the table with G, a big friendly pockmarked man, Jibril, the restaurant manager. Warsami translates between English and Arabic. G later tells me that the young small man is the real power behind the scenes. The imam explains that the sheikh will be the speaker for the committee. The sheikh is very cordial and speaks at length. First he thanks G. Then he apologizes to G on behalf of all Sudanese. Then he takes from his pocket a lump sum of 5 lira notes as the resolution of Jibril's claims and hands them over to G. G then asks Jibril to speak. Jibril says, it would be dishonest to say that I am happy with the decision, but I had to make this decision for the sake of all Sudanese. I withdraw all charges. I asked Terry to write a letter to Paola Police Station so I can withdraw all charges. G replies, I thank Jibril. You have had to take the hardest decision since you came to Malta. It shows you are a man, etc., etc. Others then speak in turn. While they are making their statements, G quietly takes an envelope, puts the money in it, seals the envelope, and gives it to Jibril. Everyone's eyes are down, but when Jibril takes the envelope, slowly folds it in two, and puts it in his office, the room hisses with an audible sigh of relief. G ends the meeting by making a speech, thanking the sheikh, saying that there was no need for an apology. He stresses that the immigrants are involved in managing the center. This is democracy. Later that night, at the pub, G gave the following assessment. It's clear the business of the meeting was to dispatch Jibril. The sheikh said that there would be a meeting next day of all Sudanese to discuss a new manager for me to choose. There was only 250 lira in the envelope, not 650 lira. And here's a comment from G on hearing my field notes. The committee assessed the damage to Jibril's property and the money he had lost, and subtracted from this the money they had lost by not reopening the restaurant when they had wanted to do so. Then they came up with the amount. I think they had a fine understanding of opportunity cost, but anyway. I had wanted Jibril to leave the meeting before the others so that I could discuss possible names for a new restaurant manager. But clearly the committee wanted to keep this decision for itself. I was slow in seeing the trend in their thinking. I'm exhausted. This is G speaking. Tonight at the meeting, I was searching every face for clues, but all eyes were down. When I finished reading these field notes, I put them down. And I asked G why he had pushed himself so hard while he was manager at Marsa. These are his words. I was firefighting all the time. On the way home from work, I used to pull into the lay-by at the golf course and sleep for half an hour. I suppose there's a sense of injustice and the romantic notion of the English stereotype of being on the side of the underdog. I am a self-proclaimed socialist. At the same time, I'm a confusion. I'm middle class. I don't know myself. So the restaurant was reopened. The new Sudanese group succeeded in ousting the old manager. The old manager was reimbursed for his losses, and the General Committee for All Sudanese gained a peaceful, smooth-running restaurant under Ghazdan as general manager. What themes emerge from this case study? What explanatory theories might be invoked? In order to clarify analysis, I will refer to all Europeans as the majority group and all Africans in MOC as the minority group. 8 themes or thematic clusters can be discerned in the events described. First, the conflict over control of the Sudanese restaurant in MOC, to a certain extent, reproduced the conflict in Sudan. Those seeking to wrench the restaurant out of the hands of the restaurant manager, a Sudanese Arab, were from ethnic groups in Darfur, bitter at their suppression by the Arab-supported government in Khartoum. At the same time, the conflict was marked by the politics of international migration in the Mediterranean. For the dissidents from Darfur were taking risks by testing their room for local maneuver in Malta. They were seeking to take control of a relatively lucrative service provided for them within the social service framework of a liberal democratic regime, the Maltese political system. Rather than relying simply on whatever jobs they could find in the Maltese labor market, these particular immigrants, i.e. the troublemakers, had the audacity, despite limited experience of Maltese culture, to play politics with local government resources. The third theme is the centrality of negotiation. In an atmosphere where escalating violence threatened, against the temptation to rely on military force, the manager of MOC persisted with negotiation. Fourthly, the way in which the conflict was managed tells us much about the nature of intercultural respect. Intercultural respect is not a floating axiom, but rather an enactment, actually developed at the edge of real conflict situations. Unless violent situations are directly negotiated, the rule of intercultural respect has little practical meaning. In other words, a creative micropolitics of intercultural engagement is essential in order to reinforce a wider message of tolerance in the macro political sphere. Intercultural respect was enacted by the manager in the very tissue of the negotiations. Specifically, he treated dissidents in the minority group as worthy adversaries, clever politicians whose logic of maneuver had to be understood, outwitted, and sometimes conceded to. Moreover, he always negotiated with a certain politesse. Resentful, marginalized Africans were called to meetings in his office as if he and they were, for all the world, engaged in international diplomacy. Thus, both the substance and the form of the discussions had symbolic content. For the manager was thereby signifying to the Africans that they had his intellectual and moral respect. Fifthly, intercultural engagement involved an intercultural partnership. Conflict management only succeeded because the manager from the majority group forged a working partnership with a gifted member of the minority group, to whom he entrusted both information gathering and some essential negotiations. His African deputy held the crucial or clinching meeting in the mosque of the Open Center with the active participation of the imam. In other words, the sacred was invoked to clothe a mundane agreement with added authority. The sixth theme concerns the salience of discourse. The secret to maintaining both his power as manager and the harmony of the Open Center was discursive engagement. He pursued a flexible and creative process of continuous verbal exchange. On the one hand, the oldest Machiavellian rules of diplomacy were being deployed to defend his situational power as manager. On the other, the manager was willing to change his cultural understanding of the conflict when his mistakes of interpretation were exposed by the minority group, for example, his mistake over the use of the Quran in swearing. Language matters. Words matter. The seventh theme concerns the nature of the power being exercised and invoked. The manager's behavior was the opposite of bureaucratic. By bureaucracy, I have in mind Max Weber's ideal type, in which officials exist to implement preordained rules in a hierarchy of command. Rather than take refuge in rules of command and civil order, the manager made up rules of engagement as he went along. Following from this, the manager from the majority group constantly involved his deputy from the minority group in political reassessments of the past and likely future moves of the various players. Instead of treating the conflict as firstly a threat to their offices, the easier renunciation of the lower official, they viewed it as a genuine politics. In G's own words, a politique. This approach to conflict management further signified their cultural respect to the African minority group. Paradoxically, a main incentive to negotiate rather than demonstrate institutional power was the manager's realization that he actually had very little power at all. For the police had quietly informed him that if the conflict were not contained, there was nothing they could do but call in the army. Eighth and lastly, full explanation is impossible without considering the ethical motivation of the manager, what I would call the less worded but nonetheless deeply felt attitude, the embodied yet mindful alertness which spurred him to persistent action. Here I can only offer the reader my surmise after a long interaction with G, at work, at home, in pubs. I infer from the manager's biography, as from the pattern of his words and actions, a refusal to countenance suffering. As poor child, pushed around naval seaman, residential social worker in London caring for violent youths with AIDS, to his being Maltese manager and counting Africans for the first time in his work experience, his imperative was to sympathize with those in pain. Thus, we should avoid an account of conflict resolution situated entirely within the discourse of rationality, including the calculations involved in move and countermove. Rather, we need to resort to a discourse of ethics in and for alterity, as when Emmanuel Levinas writes of the face of the other. These are Levinas's words. The face breaks through the form that nevertheless delimits it. The face speaks to me and thereby invites me to a relation incommensurate with the power exercised, be it enjoyment or knowledge. Infinity presents itself as a face in the ethical resistance that paralyzes my powers, and from the depth of defenseless eyes rises firm and absolute in its nudity and destitution. The being that exposes itself imposes itself, but does so precisely by appealing to me with its destitution and nudity, its hunger, without my being able to be deaf to that appeal. Rabbi Yochanan says, the presentation of being in the face does not leave any place for its opposition or contradictory. To leave men without food is a fault that no circumstance attenuates. The distinction between the voluntary and the involuntary does not apply here. Before the hunger of men, irresponsibility is irrecusable. The face opens the primordial discourse, whose first word is obligation. That is taken from Levinas' Totality and Infinity, an essay on exteriority. I take it that the first premise of phenomenology is the refined analysis of actual experience. Without claiming to be refined, this case study does reproduce the details of field notes in order to convey the confusion, the uncertainty, and the anxiety inside which men think, act, and fight. So I draw upon the messy detail of experience to offer two last comments.
First,
it might be said that the problem with the sociology of this conflict is that both the men with local authority, Terry Gosden and the cultural broker, Wasami Garari, were, to a certain extent, outsiders to the Maltese political framework. And to that extent, there is no sociological conclusion to be drawn. This, if true, would be worrying, for it would suggest that exceptionalism is part of the solution to any conflict, and where exceptions are missing, conflicts will continue and worsen. Secondly, it is easy enough for Foucault in History of Sexuality, or Deleuze and Guattari in A Thousand Plateaus, to urge a micropolitics of struggle and resistance, through which, and only because of which, power acquires a certain definition, and individuals or small groups attain the temporary liberation of an achieved identity before resuming their struggles anew. But it is far more difficult for this to happen in a multicultural milieu where contesting groups do not share axioms concerning the politically or ethically legitimate. In such situations, the possibility of an exchange of meanings, of a growing but genuine communication, deteriorates. All the more necessary, then, that there be in such crises contenders who proceed from a categorical sympathy for the pain of their opponents. Such persons are willing to suspend their judgments of the other in order to engage the other in the serious game of power. From contemplating the dilemma of Gosden, the manager, I am drawn to a final conclusion. An ethics for the other must also be a politics.
Well, thank you both for a very rich, very detailed, and very nicely presented developmental account of this conflict. Could I just make one point? Did any of these participants actually refer to the ethnic conflict in Darfur? In other words, you said that the new group were from Darfur, and this chap, is Arab and therefore was seen rather negatively. But did they ever actually bring it up either with Terry Gosden or with any other interlocutors?
From what I know, it doesn't seem they brought it up with Terry Gosden in the various negotiations. But clearly it was present in the private discussions between Warsami, the imam, and the members of the original committee who had set up the restaurant. And it was, as it were, we can add, it is kind of that unspoken element of common knowledge which filtered through to the manager in the process of negotiations. Yes. From the beginning, you will remember, the Sudanese friend who came in, Idris, who had lived in Marsopen Center but now is a well-paid mechanic living outside the center, from the very time of the conflict, he just sat down with me having a cup of tea. And he said, these troublemakers are from Darfur. They are Zagawa. So I think we are talking about common knowledge, which does not need to be expressed among the Sudanese, but does need to somehow get through to the managers of the conflict, including, in this case, Warsami, who himself is not Sudanese. He's a Somali.
I'm very interested in your methods, and I think it is... very important that you have taken a position using the biographical methods. At the same time, you're structural. You've shown the structural position of the actors, even the biographies have a structural element. So this isn't a personalist account. Your explanation isn't voluntarist. It isn't personalist. But it is combining the biographical element, the uniqueness, which is also the single particular, or the universal particular rather than the single particular. So the sort of the Bourdieu idea that we have to look at the particular, but also look at the universal characteristics of the particular person here, which is quite an important methodological position, and one that Sartre had argued for in Search for a Method, when he says the problems with Marxism is that it cannot explain these particulars. When he talks about Paul Valéry, that he is a petit bourgeois, but not every petit bourgeois is Valéry. And I think you've captured this very, very well, and it's worth exploring, because in the last two points you make, would the outcome have been different had it been a different person, and how am I going to explain it? Yes, it would have been different, but it can still be explained why this person, Gosden, had this effect. And the question about, was he able to have this effect because he wasn't Maltese? Again, would ask you to look at both his structural position as manager in a Maltese situation, but also his outsider status. Of course, local Maltese people can be outsiders too. You know, so that's quite an interesting thing, maybe worth exploring. But I congratulate you.
Thank you very much, Mary, for your comments. And although I'm aware of Bourdieu's emphasis on what you so nicely call the universal particular, I'd love after the seminar if you can give me a more
yes,
a
the
more
weight of the world in his book, The Weight of the World, all the interviews with workers.
Are these his essays towards a reflexive sociology?
No, it's a very enormous volume. The it's called The Weight of the World, Le Petit Misère in French, and it's based on a series of interviews where he takes individuals, but through a structural location, for example, the postman, and then looks at the position of postman, the clerk, the secretary, the immigrant worker, etc. Okay? And he talks about the method as well there.
Taking individuals through a structural location. That's a very nice. That's a very nice phrase. My main response would be to say that I think anthropologists, by my Marxist background emerges by their very mode of production, become attuned to seeing the particular in the general and the general in the particular. I know that I always say that my brief definition of ethnography is that it treads the fine line between theory and description. As for how I produced this account, I can tell you quite honestly that first I spent the summer of 2008 in Cambridge trying to understand Levinas, whose writing is very metaphorical, and not really succeeding. But it stays in your mind. It stays in your mind. Those of you who know my work know that ethics has been a preoccupation of mine, and I think that ethics is under-theorized in our accounts of culture, our theories of culture. And I've published in 2007 an article called Between Anthropology and the Philosophy of Ethics, How Kinship Can Help Us Understand a General Moral Template. But this was my first experience of Levinas, and his very notion of what is the ethical, what constitutes an ethical obligation specifically as opposed to a mere social obligation, involves this notion of infinite responsibility. And that, of course, gets Levinas into very difficult problems as to what do we philosophically mean by infinite? But I understand it that his notion of ethics is this experience of and enactment of unending responsibility for the other. So his notion of infinity is not spatial. It is, if anything, more temporal. And it is certainly based on the notion that your responsibility for the other can have no end. And of course it's reflexive. So the other is experiencing and enacting more or less the same unending responsibility towards you. So for an anthropologist, what Levinas may give us is an account of society or of the human being which has an extremely dense tissue. Society is very densely tissued. It's not, as in liberal accounts, loosely connected. People aren't loosely collected or connected. The tissue is well, Levinas would say, infinitely deep indeed. Anyway, when I came to write this paper, I found that my notes of the time, written up in the evenings, were, if I may say so, clear enough. Written in haste, they captured the gist better, I think, than had I had more time to sort them out into different bits and pieces. So what you have is a continuous story told by me to myself at the time. And then what happened is that at the end, first of all, I inductively drew on the contents of the paper. And I found myself very happy to see, hey, here is ethics. Because one of, at least one, possibly two of the characters or actors involved in conflict had this sense of responsibility for the other, had this sense of an ethics of alterity, were in a sense demonstrating what Levinas writes so eloquently about the face of the other and its destitution and its nudity. So it just sort of fit into place. The final point eight about Levinas just fit into place. And then when I can combine my inductive conclusions with the Levinas point, I suddenly saw a final conclusion, that an ethics for the other is not merely some sacrificial act. Rather, an ethics for the other is political. It's very negotiated. It's very scheming. It's very calculating. It's genuine politics, informed by this sense of the pain of the other. That's the way it came out as it did. It wrote itself, you know. That's how it happened.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for a wonderful story. It was like very, very gripping. I'd just like to know what's happened to Gosden since.
Yes. Gosden resigned because of growing disagreements between him and the general management and board of directors of his NGO. I choose my words very carefully because this is going out on radio. That much I can definitely tell you. It was a shattering experience for him. However it came to pass, the resignation was shattering because his whole life was so involved that he found himself, as it were, without a life. Very luckily, within 3 weeks, the General Workers' Union called him to a meeting and asked him whether he would like to take on the job of organizing third country nationals to be members of GWU. So he took this job on part-time until the present. However, a month ago, he has been given a full-time job as a project officer at YMCA, so he will probably find it necessary to reduce his involvement with GWU. This is all publicly known, which I think is a sad loss to immigration management in Malta. I have absolutely I make no bones about that. I think it's a sad loss, and I hope some of us do all we can to seduce him and entice him to stay within the sphere of migration. What I call in this paper migration politics, micropolitics, migration micropolitics.
Clearly very well-meaning individuals involved as far as the management is concerned. But both of them, you pointedly indicate that they have no experience of Sudan. I know, it's a bit kind of problematic. I mean, could someone who, perhaps someone with a wider experience of Africa, and reflecting the demographic sort of makeup of MOC, perhaps have avoided this having become a conflict in the first place by not allowing, avoiding a minority Arab in that particular context, lording it as restaurant manager, and determining and making decisions affecting a majority which was from Darfur?
I think the answer to your question has two parts. The first part is that, to be fairly frank, not completely frank, but fairly frank, I do not think the nationality or the continental origin of the person makes the slightest bit of difference. I will leave it at that. I would add that as I listen to you, it does occur to me that the whole history of these two men, the whole their own personal histories of pain, one as an English social worker from the deep end of South London society, the other as a young Somali educated immigrant who had made the big walk across the desert, had lost his wife in the process, had been detained in Malta, who had been through all of these sufferings. It's this strange combination of intelligent suffering and a lot of reading which produced a very unusual and accidental combination. That would be my first part of my answer to you. The second part of my answer would run something like this. If my line of analysis is at all correct or useful, it would frankly be to suggest that training is not the answer. That is to say, no training as such can produce conflict managers who would have come up with this kind of very negotiated and open response to a conflict. What is required is people with a certain ethical charge, and that is what seems to me to appear in the conflict. That would be my answer.
At the same time, if I may add also to Dr. Glau's answer, in actual fact, the Rogozin did allow the immigrants a lot of agency of their own. They were managing their own selves. He was, as it were, he was there, present, was taking care of all their problems, but at the same time, he was allowing them room for their own decisions. As in actual fact, the committee that Dr. Clow mentioned, it was in their own hands for them to actually tackle whatever minor, quote-unquote, inconveniences might arise. Only when it escalated, it sort of, Terry had to go in there, and he had to become a public figure in the conflict itself. Whereas if it were perhaps another manager, a totally different set of rules would have to be enacted. Say, for example, fist of steel, for instance, more rigid rules, where actually the manager or managers would be taking care of everything, including, for example, paying the rent directly to the open center itself, rather than a self-managing, self-sustaining community, see? So perhaps this might also add to Dr. Clow's answer?
Yes, I agree. We're dealing with a situation where the manager very much was giving these people a forum in which they could exercise local agency. So we need to consider that when we consider the whole relationship between structure and agency in this local context. And also he had established what I'll call a trajectory. From August 2004, when he was seconded in to take over, he had followed a certain pattern of allowing them room for self-fulfillment through shops, private shops, through collective restaurants, etc. So that in a sense, it could be argued in an expanded version of this paper, he had created the conditions which pointed in the direction of a solution. But the solution offered had a delicacy to it, which I would argue cannot easily be taught or trained for.
Hi. First of all, thank you, Paul. It was an extremely interesting paper. The only thing I wanted to add was I noticed that obviously the role of Terry Gosden in your paper tends to be very central. And in fact, at one point you said, do we require exceptional individuals in order for this kind of conflict resolution to take place? Now, I'm not disputing the fact that Terry Gosden is exceptional as an individual. I have definitely found him so. However, in assessing his role, I think you focused very much on the fact that he was very influenced by his background in the context of having gone through a kind of like purging situation where he was very exposed to pain. Undoubtedly, of course, that would help him empathize more in the situation. And, of course, the fact that he's an outsider would obviously also help him, because, I mean, as an outsider himself, he would empathize, and also he would be less likely to be influenced by the discourse of nationalism, which is impacting negatively on the situation. But I think, from having talked to Terry myself frequently, one of the things that he often told me when I was there at the Open Center was, you know, the Maltese have to be very careful how they deal with this current situation, because they are doing so from a situation of basic ignorance. And he referred constantly to his exposure in the UK to immigrant situations and how the situation can develop, how the situations developed in the UK and the mistakes that were made in the UK, and how, if the situation had been treated differently in the long run, the integration of third generation migrants might have developed very differently. So my question to you here is that maybe Terry Gosden was able to deal with the situation more positively in this context, not just because he was an outsider, not just because maybe he had been exposed to suboptimal situation in his youth, but also because he had a certain amount of knowledge and a certain amount of expertise in this area, which he then brought to the Open Center, and it is this expertise and knowledge that then made the Open Center unique in the context of helping to integrate migrants in locally in Malta.
Thank you very much for that comment, and I will try to give you as full an answer as I can. My clear understanding of Terry Gosden is that this was his first experience. Let me put it to you this way. When I read this, the notes out to him, he certainly didn't agree with the kind of wording I was using. And I knew him for many years before he took on the management of MARS. So I knew him as a project officer and a manager for that NGO in other circumstances. I suspect that in his discussions with you, what had happened was this. He had not only built up, for the first time, a personal knowledge of Africans from various countries and ethnic groups, but he had also built up, through conferencing, which he did as manager, through personal contact with social workers in Holland, England, and other countries, and through reading, a knowledge of the immigrant situation. And he was drawing on his reading and his dialogues with other immigration managers. So my own reaction to you would be to say that he was somehow conflating in his mind present experiences in such a way that they appeared to you as past experiences. However, I stand correction. I mean, if I'm prepared to go back and ask him if he had, as it were, a bit more experience of Africans before taking over Mars than I understand. But my firm understanding and experience of Terry Gosden, quite frankly, is this. Not only was he fairly ignorant of Africans, but to be quite frank, he wasn't exactly pro-African. What happened was quite remarkable to watch, and I was watching it all the time, was the speed with which he adapted to a new situation. And quite frankly, he found them fascinating. I think from an anthropological view, I would want to add this. He found them very, very interesting people. He found it a very exciting new job. Quite frankly, his view, in non-African social work context, his view of Africans was quite frankly that of a South London white before 2004, when he took on the job. And I've known Terry Gosden since 1998. So what I find, if anything, most remarkable in the developmental trajectory of this whole conflict is the fact that we're dealing with a man who was extraordinarily willing to learn. The phrase he often uses, and I leave it to him to explicate that in the right occasions, is cultural psychology. He has tried to say to as many people who are willing to listen, particularly from the university, that what is needed, including by himself, is a new understanding of psychology, which is a cultural psychology, that he would have benefited greatly from such a knowledge. So we'll see. We'll see.
Just another another methodological comment. Had you had a close informant from the group that were opposing the present restaurant's manager, do you think you would have had a different perspective on how the negotiations went? Because the positionality of your informant and your own positionality, as you describe a close friend of the main informant, obviously does reflect in the type of data you have, so, and the interpretation you've made. And again, there I would advise you to look at Bourdieu and how he managed to get from within one group different perspectives to sort of counteract the impact of having one or some informants more important than others, you know?
Well, I think I would say here that the opening up of other informants to me would obviously have greatly enriched, as well as complicated, this account. It would have been more interesting. However, I suspect, being obviously willing to change it with new evidence, I suspect that what I would have found is one moral position confronting another. I suggest what to me is very interesting in these conflicts is, yes, I would have picked up the view of the Darfurians, and it would have been possibly more explicitly ethical than that of Warsami and Terry Gosden, because the whole phenomenological account of that Levinas gives us stresses that ethics is an experience stroke action before speech. It's prior to speech. And in a very difficult passage, Levinas goes on to say that this experience or action of ethics before speech founds discourse. I'm not sure what that means, but I do know what, among other things, it means something very simple. All parties to conflicts are likely to have strong ethical positions. So I don't suspect it will have changed the theoretical thrust of my paper. I really don't. But obviously, it would be worthwhile having a richer account. That leads me to make a final point, which is this. An experimental aspect of this paper is that I wanted to see what the reaction would be to what I call the write-up of part-time research. This is definitely a one-sided account. It's a limited account. It's what I call, it's not, I don't know what Paul, our chairman tonight, has to say about this, but it's not holistic in our understanding of the kind of ethnography which gets written after extended fieldwork. It's a very much an account in a rush. An account in a rush. And I wanted to see what the reaction of people would be to this sort of anthropology in action. Well, I want to thank everybody for this discussion, and I hope it continues. Thank you very much for your feedback, and I cannot resist ending by saying to you and to our radio audience that when the government of Malta and the NGOs have the good fortune of finding locally social workers and immigrants who together can make a difference, they ought to be encouraged and they ought to be employed. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Conflict Management Among Irregular Immigrants, the Micropolitics of Intercultural Respect. This talk was delivered by Professor Paul Klauk.